They came with Bibles, maps, and muskets. But what they left behind was a broken inheritance. The Caribbean, paradise to the eye, but a battleground of power, profit, and pain. From sugar plantations soaked in blood to rebellions buried in silence, this is the untold story of how colonial empires shaped and scarred the Caribbean soul. Behind every beach lies a battlefield. Behind every flag, a stolen name. Welcome to the shadowed legacy of empire. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. The arrival of empire. First contact and conquest. Before the rum, before the chains, before the steel drums, and the dreadlocked prophets singing freedom into the wind, there was land, pure land, water so clear you could see through time. Forests whispered in the voices of ancient spirits, and people who lived in balance with the earth, guided by moonlight, stories, and memory. The Taino, the Kalinago, the Arawak, indigenous civilizations whose names have almost vanished, like smoke in a colonial wind. They were the first Caribbeans. Their islands were more than paradise. They were cosmologies. Each mountain had meaning. Each ocean current held ancestral truths. And life, though not without hardship, was rooted in reciprocity, with nature, with each other, and with the divine. But on the morning of October 12, 1492, the horizon changed forever. That day, Christopher Columbus's ships, Nina, Pinta, and Santa Maria, emerged like ghosts from the sea. Borne by winds of empire, they did not come in peace. They came with a mission: to conquer, convert, and claim. What began as discovery became domination. Columbus called the people he met Indians. He was lost, both geographically and morally. To the Spanish crown, the indigenous people were not sovereign. They were souls to be saved, labor to be exploited, and obstacles to gold. The colonial project had begun. Indigenous resistance. The Taino greeted them with generosity, gifts of cassava bread, tobacco, and cotton. But their kindness was not matched. The Spanish saw nakedness and mistook it for primitiveness. They saw simplicity and mistook it for weakness. And they responded with conquest, enslavement, torture, rape, forced labor under the encomienda system, where indigenous families were handed over like property to Spanish settlers. Within 50 years of Columbus's arrival, an estimated 90% of the Taino population had vanished, victims of disease, slaughter, and despair. A genocide hidden behind the language of civilization. But resistance lived. The Kalinago, often labeled Caribs, became fierce defenders of their land. On islands like Dominica, St. Vincent, and Grenada, they resisted with guerrilla warfare, poisoned arrows, and spiritual resilience. They refused to bow. They refused to disappear. Some of their descendants survive today, known as the Garifuna, living memory of a people the empire could not fully erase. The doctrine of discovery. Back in Europe, the Catholic Church sanctified this brutality. The doctrine of discovery, issued by papal bulls in the 15th century, gave Christian monarchies divine permission to seize lands not ruled by Christians. This legal fiction, racist and sanctimonious, would become the foundation of colonialism in the Americas. Colonialism wasn't just territorial. It was spiritual, epistemic, psychological. It came wrapped in sermons and swords, maps and muskets. Every cross raised on Caribbean soil buried a world of knowledge beneath it. Indigenous medicine, astronomy, agriculture, language, belief. To destroy a people, you must first destroy their understanding of themselves. The Catholic Church, alongside the Spanish crown, orchestrated mass conversions, erasing ancestral gods and replacing them with saints. Indigenous shrines were torched. Children were renamed. Sacred sites became sugar fields. Civilization, they claimed. Salvation, they promised. But what they delivered was extraction, domination, erasure, a region rewritten. By the early 1500s, the Spanish Empire had carved the Caribbean into a staging ground for its global ambitions. Cuba, Hispaniola, Puerto Rico. These became colonial hubs, supply chains for gold, slaves, and sugar. As more European powers joined, the British, French, Dutch, Portuguese, the islands became contested, brutal chessboards in imperial war games. Every island a prize. Every people a resource. The very names we use today, Jamaica, Barbados, Antigua, are colonial inheritances, layered over original names lost to fire and time. The island of Hispaniola, for example, once held thriving Taino settlements like Bohio, Magua, and Zaragua. Today, they are gone, erased, not even whispers on the wind. Disease and death. The weapon the Europeans wielded most effectively wasn't the sword. It was disease. Smallpox, measles, influenza, biological agents of genocide. Indigenous immune systems had never encountered such pathogens. In some villages, entire communities vanished in a matter of weeks. The Caribbean became a necropolis, its soil soaked with more than rum and rain. It held the bones of the first genocide in the Western Hemisphere. No reparations, no graves, no justice, colonial infrastructure. But what the colonizers lacked in compassion, they made up for in calculation. Spanish forts sprang up along coasts, stone bastions from which European powers projected dominance over land and sea. Cities were built on blood. Santo Domingo in 1496, San Juan in 1508, Havana in 1519. These were not just cities, they were colonial command centers designed to extract, export, and extinguish. The Caribbean was no longer a home. It had become an engine, a port, a profit machine. Conclusion, a paradise wounded. By the end of the 16th century, the Caribbean had been reshaped into a landscape of ruins and regimes. Indigenous cultures were pushed to the brink, surviving only in fragmented forms, language scraps, oral histories, buried artifacts. Yet the Caribbean spirit endured. Even in silence, the land remembered. Even in fire, the ancestors whispered. And in the centuries to come, this wounded paradise would become a cradle for some of the fiercest resistance the world has ever known. Maroons, revolutionaries, prophets with dreadlocks and burning songs. The story of colonialism in the Caribbean does not end here. It only begins. Sugar and chains, the plantation economy. In the blazing heart of the Caribbean sun, a new empire was built. Not of gold. That era was fading. This empire bled molasses. It dripped in sugar. It reeked of sweat and iron and rot. And at its core was a machine more profitable than gold, more violent than war, and more enduring than flags, the plantation. This chapter is about how sweetness became a tool of savagery, how sugar, the white gold of the West Indies, enslaved not only millions of African bodies, but entire nations and centuries of Caribbean futures. The birth of the plantation system. By the 17th century, European powers realized that the Caribbean's true wealth didn't lie in gold mines, but in the earth, in fertile soil, abundant sun, and the capacity to grow cane. Sugar cane, native to Southeast Asia, had traveled with colonial explorers. But it was in the Caribbean that it became weaponized. The plantation wasn't just a farm. It was an institution of violence, control, and efficiency. And it was rooted in slavery. The Portuguese pioneered sugar cultivation in Madeira and Brazil. But in the Caribbean, in Barbados, Jamaica, Saint Domingue, and beyond, the British and French turned sugar into the backbone of an economic empire. To feed the system, they imported Africans, by the millions. Each plantation was a small kingdom of terror. Overseers with whips, iron collars, stocks and branding irons. Tools not of farming, but of domination. The Middle Passage, a floating hell. Before they reached the plantations, the enslaved endured the Middle Passage, a transatlantic nightmare that chained human beings below deck in floating prisons. From the West African coast, Senegal, Gambia, Ghana, Benin, Angola, they were ripped from their homes, herded into ships like cargo. The voyage took 6 to 12 weeks. Many died. Those who lived arrived broken, physically, spiritually, emotionally. This was no migration. This was human trafficking at an industrial scale. Historians estimate that over 12 million Africans were transported across the Atlantic. Nearly 5 million were sent to the Caribbean alone, more than anywhere else. Entire African cultures were uprooted and replanted as labor. Language, names, religions, all forcibly stripped and replaced with colonial masks. African women were often the first targets of exploitation, raped by planters to birth future slaves. Children born into bondage. No future but servitude. Barbados, blueprint of brutality. Barbados became the prototype. In the 1640s, the British transformed the island into a sugar-producing powerhouse. The labor was entirely African. By 1680, Enslaved people outnumbered whites 3-1. The island's economy soared. So did cruelty. British laws like the Barbados Slave Code of 1661 legalized the complete dehumanization of Africans. Slaves were property, livestock under the law. A master could mutilate, rape, or kill with impunity. Rebellion meant execution. Escape meant torture. Solidarity meant death. What began in Barbados would be replicated across the region: Jamaica, Antigua, Grenada, St. Kitts. The sugar plantation became the most profitable and most brutal system in the modern world. Sweetness for the masters, chains for the rest. In London, Paris, and Lisbon, sugar was a delicacy, a symbol of status. The rich drank it in tea, baked it into pastries, snorted it like powdered luxury. But for every teaspoon of sugar consumed in Europe, a back broke in the Caribbean, a child starved, a soul was whipped raw. The West Indies, that charming colonial phrase, became a graveyard of dreams. Yet even in the darkest cane fields, resistance lived. Resistance in the fields. Africans resisted in ways large and small. Sabotage, poisoning, work slowdowns, secret religious gatherings, drumming, song, stories, language, memory. Some fled into the mountains, the Maroons. In Jamaica, they formed independent communities and waged guerrilla warfare against the British. In Suriname, the Saramaca people built entire societies beyond colonial reach. In Saint-Domingue, later Haiti, they laid the foundation for the only successful slave revolution in history. Whips could scar flesh, but not erase spirit. Plantation owners feared the spirit more than anything. That's why they banned drumming, outlawed African languages, controlled marriages and births. Slavery wasn't just physical, it was psychological warfare. But it never fully succeeded. Women in bondage. Enslaved women bore the triple burden of labor, sexual violence, and child-rearing under horror. They were expected to work in the fields while pregnant. They were raped by overseers and masters with no legal recourse. Their children were often sold away, and yet they preserved knowledge. Midwifery, herbal medicine, storytelling. They whispered rebellion into lullabies. These women were not passive victims. They were cultural warriors. The economics of evil. The sugar economy wasn't confined to the Caribbean. It funded banks in Amsterdam, built mansions in Bristol, financed the rise of Liverpool, Nantes, Bordeaux. Entire nations got rich off Caribbean pain. Britain's industrial revolution was greased by West Indian sugar profits. Slavery funded insurance companies, shipping empires, textile mills. Caribbean islands became central nodes in the triangular trade. Goods to Africa, slaves to the Americas, sugar to Europe. It was capitalism soaked in blood, religion and justification. Christianity, used as a tool of salvation, became a tool of subjugation. Plantation preachers told slaves their suffering would be rewarded in heaven. Obedience was godly. Rebellion was sin. White supremacy wrapped in scripture. But many Africans adapted Christianity, merging it with ancestral beliefs to form syncretic faiths, Obia, Vodou, Santeria. These faiths became spiritual resistance, a way to reclaim identity in bondage. Legacy of the cane fields. By the 18th century, the Caribbean was the world's most valuable colonial region, more valuable than the American colonies, more valuable than India. It was sugar that fueled this wealth. But the cost was civilization itself. Entire generations lost. Languages extinguished. Cultures fragmented. Landscapes transformed from ecosystems into monocultures. The plantation system didn't just exploit labor. It reshaped Caribbean life, land, and legacy. And its aftershocks are still felt today. In land ownership, in poverty cycles, in colorism, in the cultural trauma etched into Caribbean memory. Conclusion: the bitterness of sweetness. Sugar is everywhere. In your coffee, your cereal, your holidays. But behind every grain lies a history soaked in pain. The Caribbean's plantation economy was not an accident. It was a deliberate system designed to extract wealth, enforce obedience, and erase identity. Yet within that system, enslaved people fought to preserve their humanity, and ultimately would ignite revolutions that would change the world. The next chapter will follow that fire. The rebellions, the heroes, the rise of resistance. Because every plantation that was built also planted a seed of freedom. Divide and control, language, law, and religion. Colonialism was never just about conquering land. It was about controlling the mind. The plantation may have shackled the body, but it was the laws, languages, and religions of empire that aimed to colonize the soul. This chapter explores how colonial powers engineered division across Caribbean societies. Not only by chains and guns, but by using words, scripture, laws, and systems of belief. It's a story of psychological warfare dressed in robes and robes. Priests and judges, pulpits and gavels, holy texts and legal texts. All tools in the architecture of domination. The language of empire. Language was the first casualty of conquest. The Caribbean's indigenous peoples, the Taino, Kalinago, and Arawak, spoke tongues rooted in ancestral memory. These languages carried spiritual knowledge, ecological insight, and cultural rhythm. But colonialism, in its quest to erase the native, weaponized language itself. Spanish, French, English, and Dutch were not merely spoken. They were enforced. Indigenous words were forbidden in schools, missions, and government. African languages, Yoruba, Igbo, Wolof, Fon, Congo, were crushed beneath the boot of European grammar. To speak your mother tongue was to invite punishment. To speak the master's tongue became the only path to survival. But even in silence, tongues remembered. Out of this forced fusion came Creoles, hybrid languages born from oppression but filled with defiance. Jamaican Patois, Haitian Creole, Antillean Creole. These languages became the voice of the enslaved. Bent but not broken. Ridiculed but resilient. They turned linguistic violence into cultural renaissance. To this day, Creole languages represent a bold rejection of colonial erasure. A reclaiming of narrative, rhythm, and identity. Divide and rule. Color, class, and confusion. Colonial societies were carefully designed hierarchies. Skin tone became currency. Proximity to whiteness became power. This system, known as color stratification, divided African-descended people into castes. Mulatto, quadroon, octoroon, marabou. These labels weren't cultural, they were calculations. Colonial law used them to ration out privileges, deny land rights, and break unity. A lighter-skinned slave might be granted housework instead of fieldwork. A freed colored man might own property, but still be denied the vote. It was a spectrum of inclusion designed to prevent collective uprising. Division was survival strategy for the colonizer. If the oppressed saw themselves as rivals, they would not rise together. If identity could be broken into fragments based on shade, ancestry, or language, then solidarity could be postponed forever. The plantation may have burned crops and backs, but the real war was against unity. Colonial law, the chains on paper. If the whip ruled the field, the court ruled the colony. Colonial law was not justice. It was architecture, a system designed to legitimize theft, entrench slavery, and crush rebellion. Every Caribbean colony had its own set of legal codes, written in London, Paris, or Madrid, and enforced by local elites. Under these codes, Africans were not considered persons, but property. Marriages between enslaved people had no legal status. Land ownership was reserved for Europeans and select free coloreds. Rebellion, real or suspected, was punishable by death. Laws were not blind. They were tools of vision, instruments that saw only whiteness as human. Even after emancipation, these legal systems remained intact. Apprenticeship laws replaced slavery with indentured servitude. Vagrancy laws criminalized freedom. Property requirements blocked black people from voting. In other words, the plantation ended, but the system did not. The pulpit and the plantation. Religion was the velvet glove over the iron fist. The Catholic Church arrived first, alongside the Spanish Empire. Missionaries baptized indigenous children while burning their sacred symbols. They preached salvation while blessing conquistadors. To reject Christianity was to invite execution. To embrace it was to accept inferiority. Later, the Protestants came, Anglican, Methodist, Moravian. They brought hymns, chapels, and doctrine. Many genuinely believed in spiritual salvation. But they also preached obedience. Servants, obey your masters. Suffering, they claimed, was holy. Heaven would reward what earth had stolen. Some enslaved people embraced the message. Others reshaped it. African cosmologies merged with Christianity to create new spiritual forms. Vodou in Haiti, Santeria in Cuba, Obeah in Jamaica. These were not superstitions. They were strategies of survival, ways to hold on to power, identity, and memory. In secret ceremonies, enslaved people called down the orishas, honored the ancestors, and wove rebellion into ritual. Religion became a drumbeat for defiance. The colonizers used the Bible to enslave. The enslaved used it to escape. Education, erasing the self. Colonial schools were not meant to empower. They were meant to program. Children of the Caribbean were taught that their ancestors were savages, that Africa was a jungle, that Europe was the light of civilization. They recited poems about English kings while their own heroes were erased from memory. They were taught grammar, but not history, religion, but not resistance, Shakespeare, but never Nanny of the Maroons. To educate under colonialism was to erase and replace. This form of schooling created generations of Caribbean people disconnected from their own heritage. Fluent in a foreign tongue, loyal to a foreign crown, ashamed of their roots. Only in the 20th century would educators, poets, and revolutionaries begin to rewrite the curriculum, to decolonize the classroom, to put Marcus Garvey next to Plato, Bob Marley next to Beethoven, to say without shame, we are not the fringe of empire. We are the center of our own story, creolization, resistance infusion. And yet, despite it all, Caribbean culture did not die. It fused, transformed, creolized. Creolization was not surrender. It was cultural guerrilla warfare. It took the colonizers' language and remixed it. Took their religion and reinterpreted it. Took European laws and bent them toward freedom. The Caribbean became a laboratory of resistance. A place where African, indigenous, and European influences collided to create something new. Calypso, mento, reggae, dub, carnival, rice and peas, Rastafari, steel pan. These were not just art forms. They were philosophies, counter-histories, weapons of joy in a war against erasure. Conclusion, the invisible chains. Language, law, religion. These were not neutral tools in colonial society. They were chains, some visible, some invisible, forged to divide, to conquer, to control. But they were also repurposed. Out of forbidden tongues came Creole poems. Out of biased laws came black legislators. Out of stolen gospels came spiritual fire. The Caribbean survived not by imitating Europe, but by transforming everything Europe imposed. In the next chapter, we'll dive into the rebellions, the sparks that refused to be extinguished. Because after centuries of oppression, the enslaved did not wait for freedom to be granted. They took it. Rebellion in the blood. Resistance movements and maroons. To enslave a people, you must first convince them that they are powerless. But in the Caribbean, the enslaved never stopped resisting. Even with chains on their wrists, fire burned in their spirits. Even under the watchful eyes of overseers, they plotted. Even as the masters called them savage, they remembered who they were. This chapter tells the story that empires tried to erase, the story of rebellion, of runaways and warriors, of women who whispered freedom into lullabies, of men who carved liberty into mountaintops. It is the story of the Maroons, the uprisings, and the blood price of resistance in a region built on control. Flight before fight, the first form of rebellion. Long before organized revolts, the enslaved resisted in the simplest, most dangerous way possible, escape. Flight was rebellion. It was saying no to bondage, even at the risk of death. From the earliest days of slavery in the Caribbean, Africans fled into the forests, swamps, and mountains. They found refuge in the untamed lands and built new communities. Independent, armed, defiant. These were the Maroons, the first free black societies in the Americas. The word Maroons comes from the Spanish Cimarron, meaning wild or untamed. That's how colonizers described them. Fugitives, savages. But to the enslaved, they were heroes. Symbols of what was possible. Jamaica, the stronghold of the Maroons. No island tells the Maroon story like Jamaica. When the British seized Jamaica from Spain in 1655, the Spanish freed their African slaves before fleeing. These freed Africans took to the mountains, joined by newly escaped captives. Over time, they became organized, strategic, deadly. They launched guerrilla attacks on British plantations. They destroyed crops, freed slaves, ambushed soldiers, then vanished into the hills. Their most legendary leader was a woman, Queen Nanny. Nanny of the Maroons wasn't just a fighter. She was a spiritual leader, a healer, and a tactician. Her knowledge of African warfare, herbal medicine, and the Jamaican terrain allowed her to outwit British forces again and again. British accounts speak of her warriors appearing like shadows, melting into the jungle, impossible to catch. The British, frustrated and bloodied, were eventually forced into negotiation. In 1739 and 1740, they signed peace treaties with the Maroons, a rare moment where empire was forced to compromise. In exchange for halting their raids, the Maroons were granted autonomy over their lands. It was a victory, but one with complications. The treaties required Maroons to return future runaways, a decision that fractured Black unity and fueled debates that continue to this day. Even so, the Maroon spirit remained a beacon. Their mountain strongholds were more than villages. They were living testaments to resistance. Haiti, the fire that became a revolution. If the Maroons were the embers of rebellion, then Haiti was the wildfire. The colony of Saint-Domingue was France's jewel, the most profitable plantation colony in the world, producing sugar and coffee at brutal speed. The cost was astronomical. Enslaved Africans outnumbered whites 10 to 1. They were worked to death, literally, but they did not accept it. In 1791, the enslaved rose up in coordinated revolt. Plantations were set ablaze. Slave owners were killed. Fields ran red. Out of this chaos emerged leaders. Dudi Boukman, a Vodou priest who led the first wave. Toussaint Louverture, the brilliant strategist who organized the rebellion into an army. And later, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, who declared Haitian independence in 1804. The Haitian Revolution remains the only successful slave uprising in world history. A moment when the enslaved not only overthrew their masters, but defeated Napoleon's armies and claimed sovereignty. It sent shockwaves across the Caribbean. To enslaved people on other islands, Haiti was a miracle, a myth come true, proof that freedom wasn't a dream. It was a right. To colonial powers, it was a nightmare. Plantation owners tightened control. Laws became harsher. British and French authorities did everything they could to prevent the Haitian spirit from spreading, but it had already taken root. Every island, every fire. While Haiti was the most dramatic, it was far from the only site of rebellion. In Barbados, the 1816 Boussa Rebellion saw thousands rise against the British. It was ultimately crushed, but not before burning multiple plantations. In Jamaica, the 1831 Baptist War, led by preacher Samuel Sharp, involved over 60,000 enslaved people. It began with peaceful protests but ended in blood, with Sharp executed. Yet this rebellion helped speed up the end of slavery in the British Empire. In Demerara, now Guyana, 1823's rebellion saw African slaves rise under the mistaken belief that they had already been freed, a rebellion so large that it forced debates in the British Parliament. In Cuba, Puerto Rico, Trinidad, St. Lucia, rebellions flickered and flared, each one risking everything, each one echoing the same cry. We are not property. We are people. The role of faith and culture in rebellion. Rebellion wasn't only physical. It was spiritual. Vodou ceremonies in Haiti, Obeah practices in Jamaica, secret drumming, songs, and coded messages. These cultural practices weren't just traditions. They were the glue that held communities together. The codebooks of revolution. Enslaved people used songs to communicate, dances to train, stories to plan. The plantation thought it had stripped them of identity, but in truth, it had only pushed it underground. Resistance was in the rhythm, the cost of rebellion. The price of rebellion was unimaginable. For every successful revolt, there were dozens drowned in blood. Colonial punishments were designed to terrorize. Executions, public floggings, dismemberment, starvation. Rebels were hunted like animals, yet the rebellions never stopped. Because to die fighting was, for many, preferable to living in chains. Legacy, the spirit that endures. Today, many Caribbean nations are shaped by this legacy of resistance. Queen Nanny is a Jamaican national hero. Samuel Sharp appears on currency. Haiti remains the world's first Black republic, still punished economically for its defiance. Maroons still live in Jamaica, Suriname, and other regions, holding onto ancestral land, culture, and memory. Every steel pan rhythm, every reggae lyric about freedom, every carnival chant. These are echoes of rebellion. The Caribbean did not accept slavery. It resisted it. From the mountains to the sugarcane fields, from Haiti's revolution to whispered escape plans, the people of the Caribbean proved again and again they would not be broken. Conclusion, from chains to fire. Slavery was not a silence. It was a battlefield, and the enslaved were not passive victims. They were freedom fighters, guerrillas, thinkers, organizers, prophets, the empire counted on obedience. But in the end, it was outlasted by courage. In the next chapter, we examine what came after the smoke, the so-called freedom that followed emancipation. Because even after slavery was abolished on paper, the struggle was far from over. Freedom, on paper, emancipation and its betrayals. In 1834, the British Empire declared slavery abolished. Across the Caribbean, church bells rang, governors made speeches, documents were signed, and in the eyes of the law, millions of African men, women, and children were suddenly free. But what does freedom mean when the land is still owned by your master? What does liberty look like when your body is unchained, but your labor, your dignity, your future still belong to someone else? This chapter uncovers the painful truth behind emancipation, that what was promised as liberation was, in many places, just another mask for control. A new plantation, dressed in the language of freedom, the apprenticeship system, slavery by another name. When Britain passed the Emancipation Act of 1833, it didn't immediately free the enslaved. Instead, it introduced the apprenticeship system, a transitional period meant to prepare former slaves for freedom. What it really did was delay it. Under this system, apprentices were forced to work for their former masters without pay for 4 to 6 more years. They could be punished for laziness, absence, or disrespect, often by the same overseers who had brutalized them under slavery. Their movement was restricted, their wages non-existent. In Jamaica, Barbados, and other colonies, many realized quickly, this wasn't freedom. It was rebranded bondage. Resistance erupted. Former slaves protested, organized, and demanded immediate emancipation. In 1838, under mounting pressure, Britain was forced to abolish the apprenticeship system, 4 years early. But even then, the chains did not fall. They simply became invisible. Landlessness, the freedom that couldn't grow. After slavery, land should have been the path to dignity, to independence, to healing. But colonial governments had no intention of redistributing the land. Former slaves, though legally free, were denied access to property. The plantation class, white, powerful, and politically connected, still controlled nearly all the arable land, and they used it as leverage. If you wanted to live, you had to work for your former master. This created a brutal cycle. Workers were underpaid. Rent was inflated. Families were trapped in debt. Small plots were sold at outrageous prices or hidden behind legal red tape. The land remained in the hands of the few, while the many remained servants on the very soil their ancestors had bled for. Wages of exploitation. Free labor became the new mantra of empire, but wages were a myth for many. Former slaves were often paid in tokens, goods, or scrip that could only be used at the plantation store. Prices were fixed. Debt was guaranteed. Strikes were illegal. Unions were banned. Women, especially, were exploited. They were expected to work in the fields, raise children, cook, and serve in the homes of white employers, often for pennies. And when workers protested, colonial authorities responded with force. Arrests, beatings, even massacres. Labor had changed its name, not its purpose. Justice delayed, justice denied. Though slavery was abolished, compensation was not given to the enslaved. It was paid to the enslavers. Over £20 million, an astronomical sum in today's value, was awarded to plantation owners as reimbursement for lost property. The formerly enslaved received nothing. No restitution. No land. No reparation. Just freedom on paper and the crushing burden of survival in a society still rigged against them. The rise of indentureship. With many former slaves rejecting plantation labor, colonial powers sought a new solution. Indentured laborers from India, China, and other colonized nations. Between 1838 and 1917, over 500,000 Indians were brought to the Caribbean, particularly Trinidad, Guyana, and Suriname, under contracts that promised work and land after 5 years. But the system was riddled with abuse. Contracts were written in English, unreadable to many laborers. Wages were often withheld. Housing was inadequate. And like their African predecessors, they faced brutality and discrimination. Indentureship created new layers of complexity in Caribbean society, blending cultures, religions, and identities. But it also sparked new divisions, as colonial powers used ethnic difference as a tool to fragment unity among the oppressed. Divide and rule. Always. religion and education, freedom with a curriculum. Post-emancipation missionaries flooded the Caribbean. They built schools, churches, and social institutions. Some offered genuine support. Others imposed a strict moral code, one rooted in Victorian discipline, European values, and Christian dogma. Former slaves were told how to dress, how to pray, how to behave. African traditions were demonized. Obeah, drumming, folk healing, all were criminalized. Freedom, once again, came with conditions. Conform or be cast aside. Learn English or be excluded. Adopt their god or be seen as heathen. New forms of resistance. Despite all of this, the Caribbean people did not remain passive. In Jamaica, the Morant Bay Rebellion of 1865, led by Paul Bogle and George William Gordon, was a direct response to landlessness, racism, and economic injustice. The rebellion was crushed. Hundreds were killed. But its memory lives on as a symbol of black resistance. In Guyana, in Trinidad, in Barbados, worker strikes, peasant uprisings, and protest movements kept the fire alive. Political consciousness was rising. Newspapers emerged. Secret societies formed. Educated black leaders began to speak openly of rights, reform, and independence. The Caribbean was no longer just a place of pain. It was becoming a furnace of ideas, the long shadow of emancipation. To this day, the effects of that fake freedom echo across the Caribbean. Generational landlessness. Poverty cycles rooted in post-slavery economics. Legal systems designed by former colonizers. Colorism and classism entrenched by plantation hierarchy. Trauma inherited through silence and struggle. Yet out of this betrayal came brilliance. Caribbean people turned survival into art, pain into poetry. They birthed cultural forms like reggae, calypso, and dub. Stories wrapped in rhythm, soaked in truth. They became thinkers, freedom fighters, educators, revolutionaries. Freedom did not arrive in 1838. It was built over decades in blood, sweat, protest, and song. Conclusion: paper chains, burning hearts. Emancipation in the Caribbean was a performance, a paper document that did little to dismantle the real structures of power. But Caribbean people didn't wait for justice to be granted. They demanded it. Fought for it, created it from scraps. And that legacy continues. In every chant at a rally, every lyric of rebellion, every piece of reclaimed land. In the next chapter, we'll explore how colonial economics evolved after slavery, and how tourism, cash crops, and global trade created new forms of dependency across the region. Because the plantation may have died, but the master's shadow still lingers. Economic dependency, from cane to tourism, slavery ended. The whips were put away. The shackles came off. But the plantations didn't disappear. They transformed. This chapter is not about chains and fields. It's about boardrooms, resorts, trade deals, and hotels. It's about how the Caribbean, long after slavery was abolished, remained locked in economic dependency. A new kind of servitude, dressed in sunshine, smiles, and slogans. This is the story of how empires replaced sugar with souvenirs. How the Caribbean went from cane fields to cruise ships, and why the freedom won was never matched by financial power. The afterlife of the plantation economy. Even after emancipation, the Caribbean's economy remained focused on export agriculture, especially sugar, bananas, coffee, and cocoa. But ownership didn't change. The land still belonged to white planters and multinational companies. The profits still flowed out of the region. Black and Indo-Caribbean laborers worked the soil, but rarely owned it. And as prices for sugar and bananas fluctuated globally, the region remained vulnerable. One drought, one disease, one price crash away from catastrophe. It was an economy built on dependency. The colonial powers, Britain, France, Spain, and the Netherlands, may have loosened their political grip, but they maintained economic control through preferential trade agreements, colonial currencies, like the Eastern Caribbean dollar, foreign-owned banks and shipping companies. The Caribbean had been unshackled, but not unchained. Monoculture, the trap of one crop. From Jamaica's sugar to Grenada's nutmeg, from St. Vincent's bananas to Dominica's cocoa, most Caribbean islands relied heavily on a single export crop. This was dangerous. When global demand dropped, or storms wiped out a harvest, entire national economies collapsed. There were no safety nets, no diversification. Colonial systems had deliberately kept Caribbean territories agriculturally narrow, so they'd serve empire, not themselves. This lack of self-sufficiency meant that most food, even rice, flour, or milk, had to be imported. Imagine it. Fertile lands, brilliant farmers, but a population hungry because their fields grew exports, not sustenance. This was no accident. It was structural. Rise of tourism. Paradise for sale. By the mid-20th century, a new economic model emerged: tourism. European and North American governments encouraged their citizens to visit the Caribbean, marketed as tropical escapes. White sands, blue waters, endless rum. The region was rebranded from backward colonies to island paradises. Tourism promised jobs, and it delivered to an extent. Hotels, airports, taxis, restaurants. But the profits? They didn't stay. Here's how it worked. Resorts were foreign-owned. Flights were operated by international airlines. Tour operators were based in Miami, Toronto, or London. Most tourists stayed in all-inclusive resorts, consuming food, drink, and entertainment without ever engaging with local businesses. So while tourism appeared to be the new sugar, it still funneled wealth outward. The worker served. The outsider profited. The illusion of freedom. Economic neocolonialism. This model is called neocolonialism, when political independence masks economic subjugation. Across the Caribbean, this looked like IMF and World Bank loans with crushing interest. Foreign investors dictating development priorities. Local governments forced to cut healthcare and education to meet debt payments. Cheap labor and tax holidays offered to lure multinational companies. Once again, the Caribbean became a supplier of beaches, of bodies, of natural beauty. The export wasn't just sugar. It was identity, culture, space, the human cost of dependency. Caribbean people became both laborers and attractions, expected to smile, perform, serve. Cultural festivals were packaged for visitors. Folk dances became stage shows. Even spiritual traditions like Rastafari were commercialized, reduced to dreadlocks, reggae beats, and One Love slogans for the tourist market. Behind the postcard perfection were real struggles. Poor wages in the tourism sector. Exploitative working hours. Rising costs of living near resort zones. Environmental damage from cruise ships and overdevelopment. And for many locals, access to the very beaches advertised to the world became restricted. Fenced off. Privatized. In some places, the people who built the nation could no longer walk its shores freely. Caribbean creativity. Adapting for survival. Yet, as always, the Caribbean adapted. Local artisans began reclaiming tourism, building small goose houses, cultural tours, craft markets, farm-to-table experiences. The rise of cultural tourism, driven by authentic storytelling and ancestral pride, began to push back against corporate domination. From community-based eco-lodges in Dominica to heritage tours in Jamaica's maroon villages, a new narrative emerged. Come to the Caribbean, but come respectfully. Learn, not just consume. Listen, not just lounge. The Caribbean stopped being a playground and started becoming a teacher. Diaspora and remittances. Another economic lifeline emerged, remittances. As Caribbean people migrated to the UK, US, Canada, they sent money home. For many families, these funds were essential. They paid school fees, bought groceries, kept lights on. In some countries, remittances became a top source of national income. But this too had a cost. Brain drain. Separation. Generational trauma. The best and brightest often had to leave to find opportunity, building other nations while their own struggled. The Caribbean became global, but at the price of its own children. Reparations and economic justice. In recent decades, Caribbean nations, led by voices like those in the Caribbean community, CARICOM, have called for reparations. They argue the economic systems that enriched Europe were built on stolen African labor. The debts of slavery were never repaid. The economic legacy of colonialism still cripples development. The call isn't just for money, but for debt relief, land equity, educational investment, and historical recognition. It's about truth, accountability, healing. Some say that was the past, but the past is still in the price of bread, the interest on loans, the shape of the skyline, the food on the plate. Conclusion. Beyond the plantation, beyond the postcard, the Caribbean today stands at a crossroads. It has survived slavery, colonialism, and exploitation. But the battle now is for economic sovereignty, for systems that serve the people, not repeat the past. The cane field and the resort may seem different, but both can be prisons if the people don't own the land, the labor, or the legacy. Yet hope endures, in the rhythm of Caribbean voices demanding change, in local businesses reclaiming heritage, in education systems being rewritten, in a new generation that knows real freedom is not just political, it's economic. In the next chapter, we explore how the colonial classroom was used to shape Caribbean minds, and how Caribbean people began to decolonize education, reclaim language, and tell their own stories at last. Education, language, and colonial curriculum. In the Caribbean, the classroom became a battlefield, not of bullets and blood, but of books and blackboards, a place where freedom could be forged or forgotten. For centuries, education in the Caribbean wasn't designed to empower the colonized. It was crafted to shape them into loyal subjects, to erase what they were and reprogram them into what empire needed them to be. This chapter explores how colonial powers used education and language as tools of control, and how Caribbean people fought back by reclaiming their tongues, rewriting their syllabi, and transforming the classroom into a site of resistance. The colonial classroom, a factory of obedience. When Britain, France, Spain, and the Netherlands colonized the Caribbean, they didn't just impose laws and labor systems. They built schools. But these were not institutions of liberation. They were machines. Colonial schools were designed to instill obedience to the crown, promote European superiority, suppress indigenous, African, and Indian knowledge systems, train a small elite to serve the colonial state. Curricula were imported directly from Europe. Caribbean children were taught about British kings and queens, French philosophers, Dutch traders, but not about Nanny of the Maroons, Toussaint Louverture, or Taino resistance. Children were punished for speaking their own languages, Jamaican Patois, Haitian Creole, Pajapuri, or Creole dialects, even during playtime. The message was clear. To speak like your ancestors was to be uncivilized. To sound like the colonizer was to be educated. It wasn't just what they taught. It was what they erased. Language, a weapon of domination. Language is more than words. It is memory, identity, worldview. The colonizers knew this. That's why they attacked local tongues so aggressively. In Haiti, France banned the use of Creole in official settings until the late 20th century. In British colonies, Patois was shamed as broken English. Dutch colonies insisted on strict use of Holland's tongue, even in nursery schools. By criminalizing or stigmatizing local speech, colonial powers didn't just silence communication, they cut cultural transmission. Children grew up ashamed of their mother's voices. Elders' stories were forgotten. Ancestral songs went unsung. But language doesn't die quietly. Out of this oppression came resilience, the growth of Creole languages, living testaments to the survival of enslaved and colonized minds. These languages blended African structure, indigenous rhythm, and European vocabulary into something entirely new, the myth of meritocracy. Colonial education often promised social mobility. If you study hard, you'll succeed. But the system was rigged. Only a few students, mostly lighter-skinned, Christian, and male, advanced to secondary schools or colleges abroad. Most were funneled into agricultural or vocational programs designed to maintain the labor force. Even for the few who rose, their success often came at the cost of cultural disconnection. They became what some called black skin, white masks, fluent in empire but exiled from self. The Caribbean elite spoke Queen's English, recited Shakespeare, and wore suits in the tropics, yet knew nothing of their ancestral villages, folktales, or folk medicines. It was an education of alienation, resistance through learning. Still, the Caribbean spirit found ways to fight back, even in the schoolroom. Teachers secretly inserted local stories into lessons. Parents taught folk tales, proverbs, and songs at home. Students passed around banned books and radical pamphlets. Churches and community halls hosted night schools and cultural classes. Education became a dual battlefield. One curriculum imposed from above, another whispered from below. The winds of decolonization. By the mid-20th century, a wave of change swept through Caribbean education. As independence movements gained momentum, so did the demand for Caribbean-centered learning. Leaders like Eric Williams in Trinidad, Michael Manley in Jamaica, and Walter Rodney in Guyana pushed for education that reflected the people's history, not the empire's version of it. New subjects emerged, Caribbean history, Afro-Caribbean literature, Caribbean studies, indigenous heritage and folklore. Textbooks were rewritten. Schools began to acknowledge, if not yet fully embrace, the value of Creole languages and local knowledge. Universities like the University of the West Indies became centers for intellectual resistance, scholarship, and cultural pride. And the poets rose. The pen as a weapon. Caribbean literature exploded in the 20th century. Not just as art, but as rebellion. Kamau Brathwaite challenged the English canon with Afro-Caribbean rhythms. Louise Bennett Coverley wrote poetry in patois that celebrated Jamaican culture. Derek Walcott, George Lamming, Edouard Glissant. Each used language as a tool of reclamation. These writers didn't ask for permission to be Caribbean. They declared it, in ink, in meter, in metaphor. Education was no longer just about learning. It was about unlearning, dismantling the lies of colonial history, and finding truth in one's own reflection. Challenges that remain. Today, the fight isn't over. Standardized tests still favor Eurocentric content and proper English. Creole languages remain stigmatized in many schools. Colonial textbooks still circulate in classrooms. Funding gaps persist in rural and inner city schools. Access to quality education remains deeply unequal across race and class. But the awareness has shifted. More Caribbean nations now celebrate Emancipation Day, teach Pan-African history, and promote multilingualism. Community educators, artists, and elders continue to pass on indigenous and Afro-Caribbean knowledge. Because the goal is not just to read, but to remember. Not just to write, but to reclaim. Conclusion, from colonial curriculum to cultural compass. The colonizer used education to make the Caribbean forget itself. But the Caribbean remembered. Through resistance, revision, and relentless storytelling, Caribbean people transformed the classroom from a place of erasure into a place of empowerment. Every Creole word spoken proudly, every textbook written by Caribbean scholars, every child who learns about Nanny, Garvey, or Marley is a victory. In the next chapter, we'll explore how the Caribbean diaspora, those who left for foreign shores, carried their identity, struggle, and culture with them. From Brixton to Brooklyn, Toronto to Trinidad, we follow the journey of the Caribbean spirit across oceans and borders. Caribbean diaspora, migration, identity, and resistance abroad. To be Caribbean is to carry more than a passport. It is to carry rhythm in your speech, memory in your skin, and exile in your blood. For centuries, Caribbean people have left the islands, some forced, some searching, all transformed. Across the Atlantic, into the concrete jungles of London, Brooklyn, Toronto, Amsterdam, the diaspora formed. But leaving the Caribbean did not mean leaving the struggle. This chapter tells the story of migration, not as escape, but as extension. How Caribbean identity has traveled, survived, adapted, and resisted in lands far from home. It's about labor and loneliness, accents and ambition, racism and rebellion. It's about what it means to be from the Caribbean when you're no longer in the Caribbean. Post-emancipation migration, leaving to survive. Even before formal independence, Caribbean people were moving, not as tourists, but as laborers. After emancipation, when land was denied and wages were low, many sought work abroad. To Panama, building the canal under deadly conditions. To Cuba and Dominican Republic, cutting sugar for a few pesos a day. To Costa Rica, working for the United Fruit Company on banana plantations. They went to survive. But in leaving, they sowed the seeds of a global Caribbean presence. Windrush and the British Dream. In 1948, the British ship Empire Windrush arrived at Tilbury Docks in London, carrying over 800 Caribbean passengers. They came by invitation to help rebuild post-war Britain. Nurses, bus drivers, laborers, clerks. It was the beginning of the Windrush generation. They arrived with high hopes, only to be met with cold stares, closed doors, and cruel laws. No blacks, no dogs, no Irish red signs in lodging windows. The British Empire had colonized their islands, but when Caribbean people arrived in the motherland, they were treated as outsiders. Still, they endured. They built churches, cricket clubs, community centers. They gave Britain its music, its nurses, its fire. But the betrayal continued, even decades later. In 2018, the Windrush scandal erupted as elderly Caribbean immigrants, who had lived in the UK for 50-plus years, were wrongly detained, denied health care, and deported. Their passports were Caribbean. Their labor was British, but their treatment was inhumane. Brooklyn, Bronx, and Black Power. In the United States, the Caribbean diaspora played a powerful role in shaping Black politics, culture, and identity. From the early 1900s, Caribbean immigrants settled in New York, especially Harlem, Brooklyn, and the Bronx. Among them, Marcus Garvey, a Jamaican who became the father of modern Pan-Africanism. Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association, UNIA, rallied millions with its message, Africa for the Africans, pride in blackness, resistance to white supremacy. Later, figures like Malcolm X, whose mother was Grenadian, carried forward that flame. So did Stokely Carmichael, later Kwame Ture. Born in Trinidad, who became a leader of the Black Panther Party, the Caribbean voice became a rebel frequency in the soundtrack of American resistance. Canada, Europe, and the cold. In Canada, Caribbean immigrants arrived to fill jobs in healthcare, construction, and domestic service, facing racism, housing discrimination, and cultural isolation. In the Netherlands, Surinamese and Antillean migrants built their own parallel cities within cities, speaking Dutch but dreaming in Sranantongo and Papiamentu. Across Europe, Caribbean migrants became visible but unheard, tolerated as workers, ignored as humans. But everywhere they went, they brought something powerful: culture, sound systems, and steel pans. The diaspora's cultural arsenal. From the reggae sound systems of Notting Hill to the soca trucks of Toronto's Caribana, Caribbean culture transformed cold cities into rhythmic sanctuaries. In London, Jamaican DJs invented dub and toasting, laying the foundation for hip-hop and grime. In Brooklyn, carnival exploded into a display of feathers, defiance, and freedom. In Toronto, Caribbean immigrants created new food, music, and fashion fusions: jerk poutine, patois rap, Creole dance crews. The diaspora didn't just survive. It redefined what culture could be, blending tradition and invention, resistance and rhythm, dual identity, belonging nowhere and everywhere. To grow up in the diaspora is to navigate contradiction. You're too Caribbean for the country you live in, but too foreign for the island you left behind. You speak English, but your accent betrays you. You dance dance hall, but your passport says Dutch. Diasporic identity is layered, complex, beautiful, and often painful. It means missing home, even if you've never seen it. It means defending your culture from stereotypes while discovering it for yourself. But in that in-between space, something sacred grows, a global Caribbean consciousness. Back to the islands. Reverse migration and return. Some Caribbean descendants return home to retire, reconnect, or invest. Others return disillusioned, realizing that after generations abroad, they belong neither fully here nor there. Still, reverse migration has sparked cultural revival, diaspora investment in schools, hospitals, and businesses, new conversations about identity and belonging. The diaspora doesn't just influence the Caribbean from afar. It is woven into its evolution, reshaping politics, media, and memory. Activism from abroad. Caribbean voices abroad have led global movements for justice. In the UK, groups like Black Lives Matter UK include Caribbean organizers fighting police violence and immigration injustice. In Canada, Caribbean scholars have challenged education inequality and anti-Black racism. In the US, Caribbean artists use music and film to speak out against imperialism and identity erasure. Diaspora is not distance. It's defiance on foreign soil. Conclusion: we are still here. The Caribbean is not just a region. It is a people scattered, scarred, singing. From sugar fields to subways, from coastlines to courtrooms, the Caribbean diaspora carries the weight and wonder of its history. They were told to assimilate. They chose to amplify. They were told to forget. They wrote books, recorded albums, painted walls. They were told they don't belong. They built neighborhoods, created culture, made history. The Caribbean spirit has crossed every ocean, endured every exile, and made a home in every struggle. In the next chapter, we return to the Caribbean itself, to the flags, the parliaments, the promises. We examine what political independence truly brought and what it didn't. Because sometimes being free on paper isn't enough. The nation must still be claimed. Decolonization and the illusion of independence. The flags were raised. The anthems were sung. Fireworks lit the Caribbean skies as empires stepped back and Caribbean nations stepped forward. Independence. It had finally come. Or had it? This chapter explores the painful paradox of post-colonial freedom, how nations were born with broken bones, how sovereignty was claimed, but not fully granted, how the ghost of empire still moved through courts, currencies, and cabinets long after the colonial rulers packed their bags. Because while the colonial flags came down, many of the systems they built remained standing. The age of decolonization. Between the 1950s and 1980s, most Caribbean nations achieved formal political independence. Jamaica and Trinidad and Tobago in 1962, Barbados in 1966, Bahamas in 1973, Grenada in 1974, St. Lucia, Dominica, St. Vincent in the late 1970s. Each independence movement was the result of generations of resistance, agitation, and political organizing. Caribbean thinkers, labor unions, and Pan-African movements had laid the groundwork. But independence came with conditions. Most constitutions were drafted with heavy colonial input. Many countries retained the British monarch as head of state. Legal systems remained rooted in British common law. Languages, borders, flags, all artifacts of empire. The house had a new paint job, but the foundation was still colonial, the federation that failed. Before independence was finalized, there was a dream, the West Indies Federation. Established in 1958, it aimed to unify the English-speaking Caribbean into a single, independent nation. Leaders like Norman Manley and Eric Williams believed in its potential. Strength in unity, shared resources, a collective future. But internal divisions tore it apart. National rivalries, economic imbalance, political mistrust, Jamaica and Trinidad's early exit. The Federation collapsed by 1962, before it could even walk. Its failure taught the region a bitter lesson. Without unity, each nation would face the storms of globalization alone. Political power, economic chains. Independence brought flags and elections, but not economic sovereignty. Colonial powers had left behind fragile, monocrop economies, high external debt, little infrastructure for self-sufficiency, dependency on foreign investment and aid. Caribbean leaders faced impossible choices. Accept loans from the IMF and World Bank with harsh austerity conditions or risk economic collapse. These loans required cuts to education, health, and public spending, privatization of public assets, deregulation and trade liberalization. In other words, open your markets, shrink your government, and let the global economy devour you. This was neocolonialism, economic chains where political ones had been broken, imported democracies and foreign heads of state. Most Caribbean countries adopted Westminster-style parliamentary systems, with ceremonial governors general still representing the British monarch. Even in independent nations, Queen Elizabeth II remained head of state well into the 21st century. This meant British legal traditions shaped Caribbean justice. British honors and knighthoods continued to be awarded. Supreme appeals still went to the Privy Council in London. It was sovereignty with a safety valve, power wrapped in polite dependency. Only recently have nations begun cutting ties. Barbados became a republic in 2021. Jamaica has announced plans to remove the monarchy. Grenada, Antigua, and others are now debating full constitutional reform. But symbolic independence is only one piece of the puzzle. Who owns the Caribbean? After independence, much of the Caribbean's land, tourism, and industry remained in foreign hands. Hotels owned by U.S. and European corporations. Agricultural exports controlled by multinational traders. Media and telecoms owned by foreign conglomerates. Beaches and coastlines privatized. In some islands, up to 70% of the economy is controlled externally. Political power was local, but economic power, the real power, still lived offshore. Corruption, clientelism, and the burden of leadership. Post-independence governments faced enormous challenges. Many leaders rose with noble visions to serve, to transform, to empower. But in some cases, corruption set in. Political parties became machines of patronage. Contracts were awarded for loyalty, not merit. Foreign businesses paid for access. Elites prospered while rural and working-class communities remained in poverty. The legacy of colonial hierarchy was never fully dismantled. It simply changed costume. Still, many Caribbean nations continued to fight for justice, developing regional alliances, investing in health and education, and demanding reparations for slavery. cultural independence, where the real revolution began. If political and economic independence were partial, cultural independence was revolutionary. Caribbean people created reggae and Rastafari in Jamaica, calypso and steel pan in Trinidad, Creole literature in Haiti and Guadeloupe, dub poetry, carnival, Caribbean cinema. Through music, literature, art, and film, the region told its own story, on its own terms. Independence wasn't just a date. It was a drumbeat, a lyric, a proverb, a dance, a memory. Cultural resistance became a form of sovereignty. Education revisited, teaching freedom. Independent Caribbean nations began to decolonize education, introducing Caribbean history and literature into schools, teaching students about Marcus Garvey, Walter Rodney, and Claudia Jones, promoting local languages, dialects, and oral traditions. Young people were no longer told they came from savagery. They were told they came from strength. And in that telling, the classroom became a battlefield for the soul of the nation. Conclusion: the nation still becoming. Independence was never an endpoint. It was a beginning. The Caribbean did not leap into full sovereignty. It stepped, stumbled, danced, and sometimes bled toward it. The region is still becoming, still shaping its voice, its identity, its future, still wrestling with the colonial ghosts in its courts, its classrooms, and its currencies. But it has not surrendered. It resists, in calypso, in law, in protest, in the simple act of standing firm when the world says bend. In the final chapter, we look forward. We explore the cultural revival now underway. How Caribbean people are reclaiming memory, healing wounds, and dreaming beyond the plantation, the passport, and the post-colonial script. Because independence is not just about being free. It's about knowing what to do with that freedom, healing the wounds, cultural revival, and the path forward. The Caribbean has endured conquest, slavery, exile, and economic betrayal. It has lost names, lands, tongues, and generations. And yet it lives. It sings. It survives. This final chapter is not about what was taken, but about what has been reclaimed. It's about how the Caribbean, in all its fractured brilliance, is rising into itself, remembering what empire tried to erase, rebuilding with the bones of resistance, healing with the power of culture. Because survival is not enough. The goal is transformation. Cultural memory, digging up the buried stories. Healing begins with memory. Across the Caribbean, scholars, elders, and community leaders are unearthing forgotten histories of Maroons, midwives, musicians, and martyrs. They're preserving oral traditions, restoring ancestral cemeteries, and correcting colonial textbooks. Institutions like the University of the West Indies, the CARICOM Reparations Commission, the National Archives and Museums of Jamaica, Trinidad, Haiti, and others are leading efforts to preserve Caribbean heritage. Documentary storytelling, oral history projects, and social media movements now bring the past into public view. No longer buried in academic papers, but alive in classrooms, kitchens, and carnival streets. Every retold story is a stitch in the wound. Spiritual reclamation. Religion was once a tool of domination, but today it is also a site of liberation. Vodou, once demonized, is being understood as Haiti's soul, a complex, ethical system rooted in ancestral wisdom. Rastafari, born from Garvey's dream and Ethiopia's crown, has evolved into a global philosophy of resistance and repatriation. Obeah, Santeria, and Orisha traditions are being studied with dignity, not shame. These spiritual systems were never primitive. They were cosmologies of survival. And now they are languages of healing, the creative renaissance. The Caribbean has always been a cultural giant. But today, that power is being reclaimed with intentionality. Reggae, calypso, soca, zouk, and compa are no longer just entertainment. They are political memory, sonic therapy. Caribbean authors, poets, and playwrights are telling stories from the inside out, no longer seeking validation from the global north. Film festivals like Trinidad plus Tobago Film Festival and Jamaica Film and TV Association are birthing cinema rooted in local experience. Visual artists are using color, texture, and symbol to reclaim space and narrative. What empire tried to flatten, Caribbean creativity is reviving. And that creativity isn't just cultural. It's economic, environmental, and political. Land back. Language back. Power back. Across the region, movements for land justice are taking shape. In Jamaica, Maroon communities are asserting ancestral land rights. In Belize and Dominica, Garifuna and Kalinago peoples are pushing back against encroachment. Indigenous agroforestry is reviving, not as nostalgia, but as ecological necessity. Language, too, is rising. Creole languages are being taught in schools, published in newspapers, featured in theater. Linguists are decoding endangered dialects before they vanish. Poetry is embracing mother tongues once scorned as broken. To reclaim language is to reclaim identity. Reparations, from apology to action. The call for reparations is no longer a whisper. It is a diplomatic agenda. Through CARICOM, Caribbean nations are demanding formal apologies from former colonial powers, debt cancellation and development assistance, cultural institutions and education exchanges, acknowledgement of historical crimes, including genocide, rape, and systemic theft. Reparations are not about revenge. They are about repair. They ask, if the Caribbean gave the world its wealth, shouldn't the world help rebuild what was stolen? Youth, technology, and the new Caribbean consciousness. Caribbean youth are leading a cultural shift. Armed with smartphones and diasporic connections, they are creating podcasts about Caribbean identity and mental health, hosting digital heritage archives, using platforms like TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube to challenge stereotypes, educate peers, and build global networks. They are proud, political, multilingual, and unafraid to ask questions the older generations avoided. They are not waiting for systems to change. They are building their own. Education is liberation. Schools across the Caribbean are slowly shifting, from rote learning to critical thinking, from Eurocentric narratives to local pride, from silence around trauma to healing through knowledge. Students are now learning about the Haitian Revolution as a global turning point. Nanny, Boussa, Paul Bogle, and Jean-Jacques Dessalines as heroes. Marcus Garvey, not as a footnote, but as a foundational thinker. Education is no longer just about employment. It is about empowerment, from post-colonial to post-traumatic to post-imperial. The Caribbean is moving from survival to self-determination. It is confronting the mental scars of centuries, colorism, self-hate, inferiority complexes, generational poverty, and it is replacing them with cultural pride, mental health awareness, food sovereignty, gender and queer justice, political independence that is real, not just symbolic. Conclusion, becoming whole again. The Caribbean has never been a victim. It has always been a survivor. But now, it is becoming whole again. Not by returning to the past, but by using it. Not by imitating the empire, but by transcending it. Not by denying its pain, but by transforming it. In the drumbeat of resistance. In the laughter of children learning Creole. In the grandmother planting cassava on her ancestral land. In the rebel poet recording a podcast in a Kingston bedroom. The Caribbean rises, not as a relic of colonial trauma, but as a global force of cultural brilliance and moral leadership. It is no longer asking the world to see it. It is seeing itself, clearly, loudly, beautifully. And that may be the greatest act of healing of all.